You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Hello, everyone. I am Mireya Solis, a senior fellow at Night Chair in Japan Studies at the Brookings Institution. It is a pleasure to partner with NHK World to offer you this roundtable discussion on China's rise and the future of international economic governance. How should Japan and the United States respond? Our event this morning is going to be taped. You probably have seen that we've taken a lot of care with the microphones and so forth. And later on, it will be broadcast in several countries, really all around the world. Now, let me introduce the theme for today. We have a very rich agenda for discussion. Obviously, China's emergence as the second largest economy and its status as a trading powerhouse are well known. But its more recent attempts to exert greater leadership in international economic governance have generated a lot of attention, a lot of discussion. I'm talking about initiatives, for example, as the establishment of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, or AIB, the founding of a bank by emerging economies, the New Development Bank, the One Belt, One Road mammoth infrastructure project corridors, and the championing of a sizable trade grouping, the so-called Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. So I think that this raises a number of very interesting questions that I hope we get into today. For example, what does this flurry of initiatives tell us about China's aims and intentions? What is China's vision about international economic architecture? Is China a revisionist power intent on building an alternative multilateral economic or trade order? Or is China behaving as a responsible stakeholder willing to provide public goods commensurate with its growing economic stature? But equally important, I think we should also discuss how will established powers respond to China's greater leadership role. In particular, how will the United States and Japan respond? We're talking about two countries that are giants of the world economy. They rank number one and number three in terms of their economic size. They lead the way in multilateral institutions like the World Bank and the Asia Development Bank. And today, as we meet here, they're also trying to come to a conclusion in a negotiation of a very ambitious mega-trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So I think this also then raises a number of interesting questions that I hope we'll get in today. How can the United States and Japan protect and promote a rules-based economic order that matches the realities of the 21st century economy? In which areas of international economic governance will they be willing to accept Chinese-led reforms? In which areas will they think that the status quo is best, that the existing institutions do the job they're supposed to do? Now, to address this important and decidedly complicated set of questions, we have here a panel of world-class experts, and I will introduce them briefly in the order in which they're seated. First, Dr. Masahiro Kawai is professor of the Graduate School of Public Policy at the University of Tokyo and has had a long and very distinguished career. Some of his prior positions include chief economist for the World Bank's East Asia and Pacific Region Division, deputy vice minister of finance for international affairs of Japan's Ministry of Finance, a special advisor to the Asian Development Bank, and dean of the Asian Development Bank Institute. Dr. Kenneth Liversal is senior fellow at the Thornton China Center here at Brookings, is a prolific and insightful writer. I think, can you have like something like 24 books? You put us to shame. Was a professor at the University of Michigan and also served as senior director for Asia at the National Security Council between 1998 and the year 2000. Dr. Saori Katada is associate professor at the School of International Relations at the University of Southern California and is currently an Asia Studies Fellow at the East-West Center here in Washington, D.C. She has written extensively and with depth on a wide range of topics such as trade, financial and monetary cooperation in East Asia and Japanese foreign aid. Dr. David Dollar is a senior fellow with the foreign policy program, the Thornton China Center here at Brookings. And before David arrived here, he was the Treasury Department's economic and financial emissary to China. He has a long career at the World Bank, I think over 20 years, and he also has been an advisor for China regarding the establishment of the AIB. Dr. Eswar Prasad holds the New Century Chair in International Trade and Economics at Brookings and is concurrently the Tolani Senior Professor of Trade Policy at Cornell University. Dr. Prasad was previously head of the Financial Studies Division and the China Division at the IMF. So clearly we have gathered here tremendous expertise to discuss these very important and complex issues. And so let us get a start. And I would like first to discuss, if we may, China's economy, strengths and weaknesses. Because I think very clearly when we think about the ability of China to have a larger, leadership role, we have to see if it has the economic strength to project its influence to carry out these leadership activities. Now, we know that many people have long admired China's ability to generate high growth, to rise to become the second largest economy. But if I may say so, in the past few weeks, the confidence on the Chinese economy has taken a hit because of instability in the stock market, because of the decision to devalue the currency, because the larger than expected slowdown of the economy. So I was hoping, David, if you can get us started trying to understand what's going on in China's economy, what do you think explains the recent turmoil in the Chinese stock market? Some people say that the Shanghai stock market is a sideshow, that the turbulence is not really going to affect the fate of the Japanese economy. But some other people may look at this and say, well, this is just a symptom of larger structural underlying issues, and there are important problems ahead for the Chinese economy. Where do you fall on this?
Okay, well, thank you, Maria. Really a great pleasure to be here. You know, Maria just mentioned the stock market correction, the devaluation, and the slowdown of China's economy. Mm-hmm. Of those three, the slowdown of China's economy is by far the most important. So I do think the stock market is still something of a sideshow. They've had a big bubble. Stock prices went up 150% while the economy was slowing down, which was really strange. Prices got out of line with corporate profits. There were a couple of factors at work. They'd allowed margin trading. The government talked up the stock market, which is never a good idea. And then bubbles inevitably burst. That started happening in June. I think they made a mistake. They intervened when the market was still pretty high. The government intervened. Wasn't very effective. So now we've had a 40% correction in the stock market. I don't think that's a particularly big event. There have been stock market bubbles and corrections in China in the past. And I think the world was pretty relaxed until later, China's devaluation. But I think more importantly, this succession of poor economic news from China. So I think, the world is really worried about the real slowdown of China's economy. And they've overinvested for a number of years. So the fundamental issue is they have excess capacity in real estate, manufacturing, local government infrastructure. So naturally, investment's slowing down. It's making the economy slow down. So far, it's not bad. I think they really are growing in the 6 to 7% range. But everyone's worried that the slowdown will be much worse. I think that's what the world is reacting to. Mm-hmm.
Any other views on the panel on how is the Chinese economy doing?
Well, I think the level of interest and concern about China comes from the fact that China is the second largest economy in the world, after all, and it's become the largest contributor to global GDP growth after the financial crisis. So anything that happens in China has big repercussions everywhere. Now, it's a little difficult always to read the tea leaves in China, first of all, because of the opacity of some of the statistics and concerns about whether headline numbers like GDP growth in fact reflect the true state of the economy. So anytime things seem to be not working quite as well in the stock market or with the currency, it tends to take on a life of its own because investors worldwide interpret that as a signal of something going wrong in China. Now, I think David has hit upon the key issue, which is what is happening in the economy is really crucial. Now, my own view is that if you look at the manufacturing sector, and a lot of the indicators one hears about in the press, freight volumes, import volumes, purchasing managers index, electricity consumption, all of these are about the manufacturing sector of the economy, which has certainly taken a big hit. And as David pointed out, there's already a lot of excess capacity in terms of investment, so we can't count on that to be the main driver of growth. There is a sense that perhaps other parts of the economy, the services sector, household consumption, are all doing somewhat better, but it's not clear from the available data that all of this holds up very well. But I think the bigger issue for China really is not whether growth can hold up at a reasonable rate in the next year or two. The government has enough policy space in terms of both monetary and fiscal policy to boost growth if it wants to. But the big question is how it does it. And if it does it the wrong way, as David pointed out, some of these problems that already exist, the high level of excess capacity, the unbalanced economy, that could become worse. And that ultimately could have negative repercussions for China and indeed the world economy.
Thank you very much, Kawai-san.
I agree with David and Eswa. I want to provide some additional point, which is that right after the Lehman shock, China adopted the famous 4 trillion yuan stimulus package. That was a huge, huge package, and that impact is still lingering around in terms of excessive investment, too fast an expansion of credit, and local government's debt. So we have that sort of a problem, and in that context, the economic growth slowdown may be taking place. Now, manufacturing activity seems to be slowing down. Mm-hmm. The famous Likert-Chan index that summarizes three indicators. One is bank lending, which is growing, which has been growing relatively high, but the power consumption and railway transport volume, the last two are not doing very well. But the last two really capture the industrial or manufacturing activity. So it looks like a manufacturing slowdown is really taking place. But on the other hand, the service activity is still sustained. I believe the service activity is growing at around 8%, and perhaps manufacturing around this time 5 to 6%. So seems to me that the GDP may not be growing at 7% per year, but perhaps close to 7%. But the bigger issue is this high leverage, over investment, credit, and local government debt. So how China can manage this without experiencing a massive slowdown of economic growth is a big, big challenge.
Very interesting. And I think that there is consensus in the panel that the big item to really focus on are the structural causes why the slowdown in the economy or these more fundamental issues. But I just want to go back a little bit to the problem in the stock market. I understand that it's turbulence. It doesn't really tell us what the big picture regarding the Chinese economy is. But people have looked at that episode to make another kind of assessment, and that is the competence of Chinese authorities to deal with economic travails. And many people have been very negative in that kind of assessment. They have felt that the intervention was heavy-handed, ineffective, and has not given us confidence that there's a steady hand at the helm of the Chinese economy. I wonder, Edward, if you could react to that kind of argument. How do you assess how the Chinese government responded to what transpired in the stock market this summer?
The initial problem, which David properly pointed to, was the fact that the government did cheerlead the stock market on its way up. Now, the point I think that needs to be taken from the episode with the stock market, where they've intervened in the stock market at times and then pulled out, is what the government is trying to do, which at some level is a grand experiment. It is a grand experiment in the following sense. My view is that the Chinese government is committed to market-oriented reforms, but not in the way you and I might think about market-oriented reforms. It's to allow freer play of market forces, but while the government still maintains stability and control with a paternalistic hand. And that is a very difficult balance to strike. So what we saw with the stock market, for instance, was some set of statements that the market needed to discipline itself, that the market needed to find its own bottom. At the same time, because the market was falling too quickly and creating this perception of incompetence in economic management, they had this whipsaw approach of going into the market, trying to stabilize it a little bit, and then going out again. And that's not a very consistent set of messages. We've seen this with the currency as well, where with the initial move to a more market-determined exchange rate, initially the currency did float somewhat more freely, but then very quickly they clamped down when they thought the market was getting ahead of itself. And financial markets do often tend to overshoot, so there may be some logic to it, but unless this is communicated clearly as a more basic set of reforms, it's going to be difficult. And I think this points to a more fundamental problem with the reform process. While the government does seem very committed to financial market reforms, unless you have the real side reforms in the economy and the broader institutional reforms, it's not going to work well. So you can say that the market needs to discipline itself, and this is a country where the markets are not used to disciplining themselves. But if you don't have good corporate governance standards, accounting and auditing transparency, then those who invest in the stock market are doing it more out of a flight of fancy because the market is going up rather than because they have any faith in the fundamentals of a company. So I think what this points to is the need for a clearer communication about the ultimate objective, perhaps less of a paternalistic hand, and a broader set of reforms that underpin these financial sector reforms.
Thank you.
I would say that you'll still find Chinese officials who defend the stock market intervention, saying they prevented panic. But I think the common view in China is that the intervention didn't work. You know, the market dropped 40%, and it was probably a necessary correction. Maybe the government intervention slowed it a little bit, but you know, I don't get a sense in China that people feel that the government intervention was effective. And then on top of that, the way they handled the currency devaluation, you know, they wanted to have a more market-oriented daily fixing, but they announced it was combined with a one-off 1.9% devaluation, that created a lot of confusion. That's actually what set off the big market sell-off around the world, was people took that as a signal that maybe things were much worse in the Chinese economy. So unfortunately, I think their reputation has taken a hit. And there's this sense now, and you've seen some nasty columns. I won't mention specific columnists, but basically saying it, bloom is off the rose. It's clear these leaders really don't know what they're doing in terms of economic management. And then just one more sentence is that I agree with Eswar that there are all kinds of reforms that are needed for the real economy. Mm-hmm. They are still very closed in a lot of sectors. They need to open up. There are a lot of things that are more important than the issues we've discussed so far, but lacking confidence in the ability of the technocrats and the leadership to deliver reform, that spills over into all of these areas, and I think there's a sense that they're not moving with reform. Very large capital outflows coming out of China now, so I think it's a risky situation where they really need to stabilize expectations.
Ken, and then Kaisa.
I would agree with this. I think we should really be watching to see what they've learned from these two episodes. There clearly are very smart economic decision makers at and near the top in China. They clearly were not the ones that pushed for these particular interventions. And so we'll have to see whether the shortcomings of these interventions and the unanticipated ripple effects strengthen the hands of advisors who would have argued against the interventions if they had more access at the time. And I've heard, for example, that there are economists who really felt very strongly that the party should have pulled back from pumping up expectations about the stock market before this bubble began to burst. They were afraid to voice their views for fear that they would be punished later for having caused the bubble to burst. When you have that kind of situation, then you run into these kinds of problems. The question is whether the leadership will learn from this and make make this a little more open and demonstrate a little more finesse going forward? I think it's an open question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ken.
On the stock market issue and the exchange rate issue, there are two mistakes. More than two, but at least two. One, on the stock market, the stock bubble really took place. The interest rate reductions started in November or so last year and continued several times up until the bubble peaked in June this year. So somehow the authorities allowed this huge bubble to continue. And of course, after the bursting of the bubble, the interest rate was further reduced. And then there were some other non-market reactions. But this bubble, allowing the bubble to take place, was a very, very important mistake. On the exchange rate issue, the divergence between the reference exchange rate and the market exchange rate, this divergence had been there from the beginning of this year or late last year. So if the Chinese authorities had wanted to make a convergence between the reference rate and the market rate, they could have done so much earlier. Why would they do so in the middle of the stock market collapse? And by doing so, they sent a wrong message to the international market that the Chinese economy was so bad that they have to devalue the currency. So that was not quite China's intention. China's intention was to close the gap between the reference rate and the market rate. But that could have been done much earlier and in a much more gradual fashion without surprising the market. So clearly the communication was not correct and the timing was not correct.
Thank you, Zaman. That's really interesting. I want to go back to the reform program and, go back to the point that Ezra made that, the Chinese government is trying to let the market play a larger role. At the same time, they care deeply about stability, and there's an inner tension there. So I was wondering, David, if you could share with us your views as to whether the reform program in China is on track. Can China, as Professor Kawai also mentioned, is trying to move to a different economic model, one less driven by investment, one more driven by consumer demand, perhaps services will play a larger role. Is China on track to do that? Or do you think there will be a lot of bumps ahead, a lot of stepping back?
Okay, great question. And let me start by saying the discussion so far has been pretty negative. So let me switch gears and be a little bit more positive.
Very good,
So just a sentence or two before I answer your question. Mm-hmm. But, there is real progress with this rebalancing. And Hiro talked about the service sectors are growing much faster. You quoted the real GDP data, which is important. But it's interesting, in the nominal GDP data, industry is growing at 2, and services are growing at something like 11 or 12. There's a bright spot. Service sectors are growing. Consumption is mostly services. Household income's going up. I think a lot of that's being driven by demographics, to be perfectly frank. So there's some good things happening. And then on the reform, they've laid out an ambitious agenda in their third plenum resolution. To be fair, there's some areas where they're moving ahead. They're doing quite a bit on financial reform. But also, they've made it much easier to register enterprises, for example. So there's been a big surge in private enterprise registration. You can point to some specific things. That said, you're going to find economists like me who are frustrated that having laid out a very nice plan 2 years ago, there's a lot of it that they're not moving on. And one of my favorite issues is, these service sectors that are growing, they're still largely closed to foreign investment and foreign trade. They could get a lot of dynamism by opening up financial services, telecom, healthcare, logistics, and they're moving very slowly. So I think it's a mixed picture, but let's not be too negative. There definitely is some parts of the reform that are moving, and there are some real evidence of rebalancing. I think the world's gotten a little too negative about China this year. They will, they will get close to their 7% growth target this year.
Would it be fair to say, Eswar and David, that the world perhaps a little bit negative because, you know, as larger as China's economic footprint grows, many countries have become dependent on how the Chinese economy is doing. That can be an opportunity, but it can also be a risk. And we know that the commodity market, for example, has taken a hit. So I wonder how much have other countries been affected by what goes on in China, and is that affecting our view of how deep or not so deep are the problems in China?
And given how much China is contributing to global GDP growth and given how important it's become in specific markets, especially commodity markets, anything that happens in China does have ripples worldwide, especially to the smaller commodity exporting economies. And there is also this irony here that if, in fact, this rebalancing program that David talks about does get a lot of traction, and there has been progress in addition to the indicators he's talked about, that services sector now accounts for a slightly larger share of the economy than the manufacturing sector. The share of consumption, that is total consumption, private plus public as a share of GDP, is now a little over 50%. The household saving rate is no longer rising. So all of this suggests an economy going in the right direction, but very slowly. But if China does shift very substantially, then it's going to mean much less investment-driven growth, which is going to mean much less demand for commodities. But of course, the good thing for the rest of the world is if China starts generating more domestic demand through consumption rather than through investment, there is going to be less excess capacity that will need to be exported to the rest of the world. So things are moving in the right direction, but very slowly. But this issue about the reforms, I think David has correctly pointed out that the notion that reforms have completely stalled is not quite right. But my concern, which picks up from where he left off, is that we are getting a slightly unbalanced approach to reforms, with financial market reforms moving forward, perhaps slowly and in a very erratic way, but the intentions do seem to be good, and they are making progress on some issues, like one of the issues was liberalizing interest rates, so that both deposit and lending rates could be determined by the market. They are almost all the way there. They are freeing up the currency in their own way. There is a formal, explicit deposit insurance system in place. So things are happening slowly, but on the real side of the economy, the progress has been much more limited. And I think this unbalanced approach, where you have more financial market liberalization, perhaps more capital account opening, without the real side of the economy being fixed, that poses some risks in itself. And I think this is what makes it a particularly fraught time for China. Not that there is no reform, but that the reform is taking on a slightly unbalanced aspect.
Kawai-san and then Ken.
Yeah, this shift from investment-led to consumption-led economy, and also from manufacturing dominant to services-driven economy, these two are taking place, but very, very gradually. Now, Eswar mentioned the number, the consumption to GDP ratio being 50% or so, but household consumption to GDP is just above 35%, which is extremely low, and investment to GDP ratio is more than 45%, maybe 47% or so. So investment has to come down and consumption has to go up. Now, the sort of average world household consumption to GDP ratio would be something like 55-60%. So China has to move a long way, this 20% change, and that cannot take place within a very short period of time. It's a matter of 10-year program, maybe even 20 years or so. So. But this transformation is something that that is going to go on. But during this process, China is going to be less dependent on import. Commodity import would be less, and also China's domestic ability to produce value added would become higher. So during this economic transition, transformation of China, the impact on global trade is going to be gradually negative. although services sector development may have some potential to generate services trade. But the point is that the impact on those economies that are heavily dependent on export to China would continue to be affected.
Okay. So, Ken, sorry, I think you had a couple of points, and then I'll move on to talk about the leadership initiatives, because we need to talk about what China is putting on the table. But, Ken, I think you had a point on,
well,
on this.
We have to keep in mind in China that this is a huge political system that is in reality very decentralized in terms of operational policies. So what we've seen with Xi Jinping is a man who is personally dynamic, almost charismatic. He has really dominated the kind of setting of broad goals, the directions in which to move, and the vocabulary that we talk about with that. And it's not surprising to me that it's in the financial side that we've seen the most reform initiatives, because those are the things that a relatively small group at the top can decide on, and everyone has to react to, reserve ratios for banks, interest rates, et cetera, right? But most of the economy has depended on the initiative of leaders at provincial level and municipal level and county level and township level. At each level, there's a huge amount of flexibility. And I think the reality is that the way the current leadership has been promoting its efforts has actually made it more difficult for local level leaders to get on board and to take the initiative. I could explain in more detail, we're out of time, but let me just say that for a lot of this, you have to keep in mind that there is a huge political reform that's a necessary component of this. I'm not talking about democratization, I'm talking about differently incentivizing local level leaders, and they haven't figured out how to do that effectively at this point.
Very interesting. Sorry?
Well, I have more questions than answers given the kind of expertise we have on the table. But, you know, one thing that the Chinese leadership has to manage is not the external expectations but internal. And when this shift is taking place and now Xi Jinping has pronounced this new normal, and you know how that would affect the political stability. And obviously, the provincial so on is important, but the general public has been feeling that change too. So I wonder how that would affect the Chinese political system. Also, the other element that I would like to know more about is the surplus capacity that China has. I mean, Kawai-sense has mentioned that there's a shift change taking place. But China has this massive machine of production and construction and so on and so forth. How would that, could that be dealt with in terms of employment, investment, and so on? And I think that might kind of lead into the international dimension, but yes. I would like to kind of ask the experts on this.
Well, if you don't mind, let us jump into discussion about the new initiatives on international economic diplomacy and how they may be tied in to the domestic economic needs of China, the political constraints or opportunities, and so forth. So if maybe David or Ezra or anybody else could start telling us what is new in Chinese international economic diplomacy. I went in the introduction through several of the initiatives. How far do they go? Why have they generated so much attention? Is there something really new here in what China is putting on the table?
Well, I think what's new is the Chinese, capital has been leaving China for a while now. I mean, China's become a major creditor around the world. There's a lot of Chinese investment in different parts of the world, Chinese financing of infrastructure. So some of these initiatives like Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, it's hard to say that the whole impetus is new because China's been doing things like that. So what's new is doing it in a multilateral framework. And then with the One Belt, One Road, I think you also have to say the scale is definitely rising. And I think you then bring in the fact that the leadership of China feels that China's reached a point where it should play a more assertive role in the world, and so doing visible things like AIB makes sense. So I think you have the confluence of politics and economics encouraging these initiatives. And then my own view is we should be happy that China's pursuing some of this through multilateral channels, and China's actually a big financer and supporter of the World Bank and the IMF and the existing institutions. So China's, making a lot of money available for the existing institutions, plus its new efforts. And I think we should largely have a positive attitude about that, though there are some concerns that are raised.
Great. Ken.
President Xi convened a conference almost a year ago now, somewhat unusual conference in the Chinese context, that was a broad review of foreign affairs and China's role in the world. And one of the major themes of that conference was that China, although it remains a developing country by many measures, is successful enough that it should become much more active and assume much more responsibility in provision of public goods and in participation in multilateral organizations as well as its own individual diplomacy. And I think we've seen that contribute to this sense of a willingness to take more initiative, not just to react and to plead, but to take initiative and in some cases try to lead. And I think they're seeking to learn how to, say, through the AIIB, how do you actually run a multilateral organization? What is involved in that? How do you make that successful and not make it appear to be just an extension of Chinese foreign policy, but rather be China as a real contributor to Asian development? So this is, it's a change of mindset, and I think that really informs part of the difference in initiatives that we've seen as versus, under the previous administration in China.
Saori, and then Kawai-san.
So in some ways, is China doing what U.S. did in the 1940s through the Bretton Woods system? Is it the kind of starting point of much more kind of a larger challenge, or would this be more of the way for Chinese leadership at this point to demonstrate that it has kind of create more legitimacy in kind of creating these institutions through the kind of domestic reform, kind of in the domestic audience?
I think China has been told for some time now that as China's capabilities increase and its willingness to contribute increase, the Bretton Woods institutions will adjust to give them a larger role. I think they're trying to play a larger role. They've been frustrated in some parts of that. IMF reform is the prime example. And so they're also increasingly taking initiative in, to create new institutions and contribute to them. My guess is the Chinese don't know where this will come out. And part of it will be a reflection of the capacity of the Bretton Woods institutions to be responsive and vibrant with a greater role not only for China but for other relatively successful developing countries. So we'll have to see how that plays out. But I don't think they start off with a totally revisionist mindset. And at the same time, I think they're demonstrating that they aren't willing to sit there and just be frustrated either.
Kawai-san.
Yeah. Well, China became the world number two economy in 2010, measured by the market exchange rate. Today, at the PPP, China is number one, exceeding the U.S. China, having become one of the largest economies, wanting to play a much bigger role internationally and multilaterally, that's quite natural evolution. Japan, in the 1960s, established the Asian Development Bank together with the U.S. And other countries. That was in 1967, and Japan became the world number two economy in 1968. So for China, it's very natural. So we want to see on the part of China is to play really a constructive role, providing international public goods that the rest of the world would need. So there is a potentially positive aspect, although we don't know the political intentions behind this move. So I'm sure we continue to discuss today,
yes,
this political intention issue also.
Yes, we will. Thank you so much. Ezra, you also wanted to join this.
So,
China is a large and economically powerful country, and this is a role that it has ascended to recently. And like an adolescent growing into adulthood, I think it was very awkward in terms of its international engagement, somewhat using rather brazenly its economic power to put forward not only its economic but also its geopolitical and strategic interests. What I see in the last couple of years is a much more savvy and disciplined way of engaging with the world, saying let's not just do it in our terms, but let's do it through a broader multilateral engagement process. And this, I think, is a much better approach. Now, one interesting question in terms of international governance, to build on the points that have been made here, is whether China is actually trying to rewrite the rules of the game of international governance. And I sense that there is some of this, but I think the Chinese policymakers have become savvy enough to recognize that trying to impose their own set of rules on the game is not going to work very effectively. But setting up the institutions like the AIIB, where they aspire to not only follow the rules of international governance, but do better than the existing institutions, serves a very useful purpose. Number one, it gives China a lot more influence in designing the rules of the game in the future. And second, it serves as a catalytic role, or to put it less technically, gives a kick in the backside to the existing institutions to get their acts together in terms of improving their own governance. So I think, to borrow a phrase from Kawai-san, this more constructive approach to international engagement by China is certainly a positive move, in the sense that I think it is going to contribute eventually to better global governance. But then the question becomes, at what point does China start trying to write the rules of the game in its own fashion? We are not there yet, but I think we will get there, and it's going to get more interesting.
Yes, indeed. So let me ask a question about the timing. Because I think that when people talk about China's international diplomacy, they always make reference to the fact that China for a long time decided to keep a low profile. And that seems to have gone out the window. And they clearly are out there with a number of, you know, attractive, compelling, to some controversial initiatives that we're discussing today. So why now? I mean, we can think about perhaps the fact that it's a capabilities issue, the fact that China now, since 2010, is the second largest economy. But it seems to me that there's something about the current administration of Xi Jinping that seems particularly proactive. Because those capabilities were already present in many ways in Hu Jintao's era, right? So we're going to try to decide what changed the mindset of the Chinese, why they're willing to now go out on a limb more and have their own ideas, the AIB, the One Road, One Belt, all of this. What explains the timing? Is it capabilities? Is it that we are living in an international system in transition, a plastic moment, if you will, where the Chinese feel that they can have an imprint because we're seeing the Bretton Woods institution under stress? What is your sense as to why we are witnessing these new initiatives today? So, I'm sorry, you want to jump into that?
Yes, I think I can see two kind of basic forces behind this. One is what I mentioned, the domestic. So new normal with the excessive capacity, so on and so forth. It has to be, has to have some way to get this out of the system, which would allow China to have, you know, more investment abroad. Obviously through bilateral channel too, but again with various reasons of the governance and the challenge to the existing system or reform, to, you know, kind of a incentive to reform existing system, that will be one basis. So timing is the slowing down of Chinese economy that kind of triggered more incentive for it to go outside, and obviously that's been happening. I think the other one that I would like to put on the table as a political scientist is the geopolitics. I think there is this kind of impetus for China to go west instead of looking at the Pacific. No, solely. Obviously, U.S. is on this side, you know, Japan, so on and so forth. And in order to kind of, you know, China would like to avoid a major confrontation or clash with the kind of Pacific side. And there are a lot of benefits to be gained on going west. First, you know, China is very good terms these days with Russia. China needs a lot of investment in these kind of Silk Road going to the east, and going to the west, and also China's relationship with Europe
is getting increasingly important, as well as the access to resources and market and so on in Middle East and Africa. So I think that impetus has emerged quite clearly. You know, BRICS is surviving despite of many of the challenges. I think all these have triggered China to be very interested in this type of initiative.
Would you say that China's aspirations are regional or global?
I would say global. So picking up on the last comment, so, you know, I understand China's interest in the, you know, going west, having different supply lines, natural resources. But the Central Asia is essentially a set of small economies. So there will be an opportunity for some very specific resource-related investment. I'm very skeptical that anything like high-speed rail all the way to Europe, I just think this is not going to be economic. Sea travel is much, much more efficient than land travel. So you know, I'm skeptical that there's that much opportunity for China to go west. There's definitely some, and they'll exploit it. I think it's interesting, President Xi started talking about a new Silk Road initiative, which would have largely been to the west, and very quickly, as I understand it, coastal provinces in China and other interest groups said, wait a minute, we can waste a lot of money investing in Central Asia. So the whole notion of one belt, one road, right, is to say, well, strengthening the maritime route is as important, and I suspect that over time there'll actually be more investment opportunities. As you think about the maritime route, you go south from China to coastal China, Southeast Asia, you know, India, on to Africa. When I talk to Chinese officials about, you know, what does One Belt, One Road encompass, the answer is the whole world. You know, Africa is part of One Belt, One Road. Latin America is part of One Belt, One Road. And investing in the United States, this is the biggest destination of their investment. You know, so I just see it as a much more general, big global push for Chinese companies, which have capability now to go out, and China has resources. And so, yes, investing in Central Asia will be one component, but there will be very significant investments and activities elsewhere.
But other parts are already going on now, I guess. Maybe it's the interest. But anyway, yeah.
I'd be interested in the political scientist's view about something that I think you had alluded to, Maria, which is how does this interaction with the rest of the world feed into domestic politics, or how does domestic politics feed into this? So, for instance, if you think about the setting up of the AIIB, it gives China a leadership role. Does that create more space for the leaders who want reforms to sort of say that we need to make changes in our economy so that we can lead more effectively? Do you think there is any major feedback effect?
Do you want to take that? I'll take later, too.
Insofar as we can judge popular opinion in China, I think that there has been a lot of evidence that there is strong support for China to play a larger role and more of a leadership role in global institutions and regional institutions. This previous notion of let's kind of be modest about our capabilities and be patient is one that increasingly was out of step with the sense of what China has accomplished and what its role in the world ought to be. So I think, yes, it does create some more space for leaders domestically. There's another dimension to this. With TPP negotiation, as you mentioned earlier, Maria, is hopefully reaching a conclusion today or tomorrow
we'll
or something like that. We've seen in the past China has taken international obligations as a vehicle for promoting domestic reform. And I know that a considerable amount of discussion in China has been if TPP does get established, should China seek to join in part to use the obligations of joining, obligations imposed on China, to promote some of the more difficult domestic reforms and to show that, you know, China can meet its international obligations and be a major player. And so there's an interesting feedback mechanism in kind of both directions. There's popular support for a larger international role. Accomplishing, developing leadership positions internationally increases the space for leaders domestically. But at the same time, taking on international obligations gives them more leverage to push through reforms at home, lest they be seen as failures in their international efforts. So it's a dynamic that I think is generally likely to be more beneficent than destructive.
I think in some ways it strengthens the hands of those who are trying to reform the country, right? So once, like we were just discussing SDR issue, the fact that SDR is going to be, planning to be in, renminbi is going to be part of the SDR, would strengthen the hands of those who are promoting, international role, the reform change, in the domestic side. I think that legitimizes what they're doing through the international channel, and I think it does. I totally agree with Ken was saying in that realm.
Kawai-san, thank you, sir.
Just going back to China's intentions and objectives behind all of these international and multilateral objectives. I think, as long as the One Belt, One Road initiative and projects financed by AIIB would provide large economic benefits to other countries, I think that itself would be a good thing. On the other hand, there are countries which consider China's intentions to be largely geopolitical rather than geoeconomic. One big example is India, I think. India does not seem to have endorsed the One Belt, One Road initiative as a fundamentally good initiative because that involves highly geopolitical elements. So I think one of the challenges for China is to show the rest of the world that its intentions are not for China's own economic and political, geopolitical interests, but for the benefits of other countries. So in that sense, China would have to show that their projects may benefit to some extent China, but for other countries' economic benefits.
Yes, that's an excellent point. And I think that when we discuss what are China's aims and goals, there are different ways to approach this. One is to think, well, is China trying to provide public goods, or is it an exercise in mercantilism? It's a geopolitical game. That would be a way to discuss it. The other way in which we could discuss it, and I would really like to get into this, is, and Esma already alluded to this, and several of you, in fact, whether we are seeing the emergence of a revisionist power or not. And I think that this label is used very loosely. And any change sometimes is equated with revisionism, and we have to be careful because there is a difference between revisionism and reform, and obviously the boundary might be hard to establish. But when we think about international economic governance, it can be in finance, development, trade. We have expertise on all these issues in this panel. What do you think would qualify as revisionism, and is China practicing it or not? I succeeded to create a moment of silence. Maybe let me get started on trade, and then maybe all of you can. For example, I would think if China is deliberately trying to create a zone in Asia that excludes the United States, that from the point of view of the United States would certainly be bad news and a major change. But I don't see China doing that. I see China championing the free trade area of the Asia Pacific, which by definition satisfies a core national interest of the United States, and that is we're talking about Asia Pacific. We're not talking Asia for Asians only. Then RCEP. RCEP might not be, it's not including the United States, but it's not very ambitious. It's not trying to create an alternative set of rules. It's actually just having low ambition with existing rules. So in a number of dimensions, I see Chinese initiative, but I don't see revisionism. And I wonder if you think that in your own areas of expertise this applies, or in fact that China it is perhaps making initial steps in trying to change the nature of the order itself.
Well, I think revisionism is a kind of a relative term, right? So it depends on what the status quo, then it defines what revisionism is. And status quo is defined by what advanced countries have done, So it's the interest of the U.S. and Europeans, which created the Bretton Woods system. Japan kind of struggled to get in, but, you know, usually have this kind of uncomfortable fit. Nowadays, fitting much better than it used to in the 60s and 70s and 80s. Japan has had been, you know, has experienced a lot of criticism and challenges and so on and so forth. So where China sits at this point of its development and political stability and everything else kind of trigger, motivate them to propose something that fits its level of development, its, you know, to some extent, its political system. So they are proposing something obviously somewhat different, or maybe quite different, like TPP versus RCEP, or World Bank versus AIIB. But is that revisionism per se in the sense that China wants to actually change the system? No, I don't really think that way. China benefits immensely from the global, you know, open global system for the last 30 years or so, and I don't think it wants to destroy it. So in some ways, it wants to have the cake and eat it too. So it wants to benefit from what's existing, this liberal system of free trade and, you know, investment and so on. But at the same time, it needs to, at least within the region maybe, maybe a little beyond, but at least within the region, to have this comfort zone where rules apply to the countries which are in, you know, in this level of development, in, you know, kind of having certain, you know, uniqueness, idiosyncrasies, or maybe, you know, kind of which might need reform, but maybe, but no, that's been what China is at this stage. So I think that's, you know, where it stands.
Very interesting. Kawai-san and then David.
Yeah. Well, China criticizes the Bretton Woods institutions and other major ADBs, like the ADB, as being dominated by developed country interests. And clearly, China wants to reform the system. So AIIB is, you know, one important instrument. And AIIB is basically owned by developing countries in terms of the voting share. Whereas other IFIs, the IMF, World Bank, ADB, and so forth, are basically owned by developed countries as major shareholders. So China may want to reform the international financial system by providing a bigger say of developing countries. But from the point of view of developed countries, that may appear to be a challenge to the existing system. So this definition of China being a reformist or revisionist, perhaps there is some murky, point. In other words, it has an element of a challenger of the existing system. On the other hand, that sort of challenge may be a healthy challenge because of the rising importance of emerging economies in a global economy. So what is needed is to ensure that these two would work together in the transition, period, where eventually many international organizations may have to be dominated by developing and emerging economies because their relative size of GDP would be dominant in the future. Perhaps we are sort of in a transition period.
Very interesting way to frame it.
See, I don't see China as a revisionist power in the economic realm. You know, when we set up these institutions at the end of World War II, the UN agencies were based on one country, one vote, right? But we deliberately set up World Bank, IMF on a shareholding basis on the argument that those institutions should be run on the basis of countries' weight in the world economy, world trade, et cetera. So as they were set up, as Hiro said, they were dominated by the developed economies, including Japan, which had the vast majority of world GDP. Now the world's changed. Developing countries have now more than half of GDP globally, and that's going to increase. So I see China pushing for us to just be honest about the system we set up, which is, let's have our Chinese as president of the World Bank. Let's, let's break out of this rut of always choosing an American. Let's change the weights within these institutions, et cetera. So I see starting AIB first, I think it's consistent with the global system, and I also see it a little bit as China hedging You know, they would like to see the existing institutions evolve, and to be fair, they are slowly evolving. You know, but China and other emerging markets are frustrated, so they're hedging. And they're saying, okay, you know, we're going to run our own multilateral development bank. And as Eshwar said, it creates some healthy competition for the existing banks. I'm sure there'll be enormous public scrutiny on what AIB does, and that's going to be a very healthy, positive thing, you know, hopefully leading us to good results.
Okay, great. We have to move on to the next set of topics, but Eshwar, if you have a very pressing point that you would like to make, okay. So I think we've had a really robust discussion, an insightful conversation. We started talking about where is the Chinese economy at? You know, how should we think about the stock market turbulence? How should we think about the competence of Chinese authorities to deal with this problem, but very quickly moved on to talk about the slowdown, which is the big issue to be paying attention to, the tensions in the market reform program, that it's a mixed bag, that there's progress, and I think very interestingly that China's role may change as its economy is transformed, as reforms are being made, and of course the political determinants of the reform, I think was also a very interesting point that we covered. And then after that we talked about what is new. In the sense of, you know, China now making use of these capabilities, its greater willingness to offer public goods, perhaps coming with new formulas to address old issues. And we got into a much more fine-grained discussion as to what revisionism means or does not mean. I think taking the temperature of the panel, most people felt that we're not really seeing yet revisionism. But, of course, every time there's a reform process, there's going to be tensions, and we don't know yet how far will China take this. So we cannot be rest assured that this will not go in a different direction. Now it's time to move to the next set of issues because there's so much to cover and now talk about, well, how are established countries like the United States and Japan responding to this shifting landscape in international governance where emerging economies are likely to play a larger role. It might be China, it might be India, it might be other countries, and where we may see the composition of the Bretton Woods institutions shift. We may see the emergence of other institutions and then the coexistence among them. The division of labor needs to be worked out. So there's a lot to discuss in the next segments. And I would also like to, at the end, talk about future scenarios, cooperation, rivalry, to put it in very broad terms, but where do we see ourselves going in terms of China and the other two giants of the world economy and international governance? But let me start then talking about how the United States has responded to China's decision to have a higher profile in the management of the world economy. And I think this is Washington, and therefore there's been a lot of discussion on one issue, and that is the establishment of the AIB. And Ken, as you well know, the United States looked defensive in its initial reaction. Some would say even obstructionist by talking its allies perhaps into not joining, and to no avail, because there was a rush of countries desiring to be part of this. Why do you think the initial reaction of American government was like this? And do you think that since then, given all the heat, has there been a significant recalibration
sure.
in strategy?
I think if we had it all to do over again, we would not have done it the way we did it. That's clear. I think the initial reaction was some combination of two factors. One was the clear inability of the Obama administration to get the Congress to agree to the change that was needed in order to implement the 2010 reform program at the IMF. And the U.S. had been telling China for some years, as you grow, we will accommodate, including in international institutions. That's all part of the long-term engagement effort to get you to be, you know, an active, constructive participant in international institutions. In this very visible area, we failed, and we failed largely because of domestic problems that we have. So it was in part embarrassment that China went in that direction, and then in part also concern over what the rules would be, you know, who could join, what the voting shares are, you know, what the
selection of projects would be like, how transparent it would be, and so forth. And so before we wanted to be leaning in that direction, we want greater clarity on that. Now, the problem was, of course, as China moved to clarify, and I think in the process of consultation with us and many others, upped their game quite a bit, improved what they were trying to do quite a bit. The administration didn't move with it, and rather, publicly said essentially, we're neutral, and privately clearly was communicating to Australia, to the British and others, and to Japan that we all ought to stay out of this thing. Then we got caught on that. So I think the view has now changed. I mean, I think there is a genuine sense of embarrassment over what occurred. And so going forward, you can see in the announcements that were made during President Xi Jinping's state visit to the United States, the U.S. made very clear, that we support the establishment of this kind of organization that is high quality. So long as it meets the standards, good thing. It's a separate issue as to whether we will join it, but certainly the rhetoric back and forth was a different tone and different substance from what we saw even 6 months ago.
So question for you and the panel. Should the United States join the AIB? And related to that, can the United States join the AIB?
Should we join? I think we need to engage, and I think we will clearly do that. I would hold off for a couple of years to see how this goes and then maybe make a decision on that issue. Will we do that? Tell me how the presidential election is going to come out next year, and I'll have a more informed answer to that.
Other views on this?
There is a deep and delicious irony in a country that, because of petty domestic political disputes, cannot even push beyond the goal line, the international governance that it itself pushed for, now expressing skepticism that the Chinese may lead a race to the bottom in terms of international governance standards. And I think the Chinese have, as Ken and others pointed out, rightly risen to the challenge. It's interesting, going back to our discussion about the rules of the game, they did not say, this is our institution, we will make the rules. They said, we will take best practices, we will take, since we're starting with a blank slate, all the areas in which the existing institutions don't seem to have the governance structure right, and we will make it work right. For instance, there is no resident executive board, which, having worked at the IMF, clogs up the working of the institution more than it actually contributes to it. The Chinese have said they're not going to have a veto power, although they're going to be the largest shareholder. And all indications are that they are going to apply good governance standards in terms of the projects that they lend to. Now, we haven't seen the evidence of that yet. We don't know if China is going to exercise a very heavy hand in the running of the institution. We don't know if the projects will be judged on the right sort of criteria before loans are made. But certainly, China seems to be aspiring to the highest standards rather than leading a race to the bottom. So in that sense, it's certainly potentially promising outcome. And as others have alluded to, this could also lead to the right sort of catalytic effects in terms of the international governance structure right now. So I think the U.S. at one level needs to decide how it's going to start thinking about its own constructive engagement with the rest, with the changing world order, where it doesn't get to impose rules on the rest of the world, because frankly the nature of the game has shifted. Now, can the U.S. join, or the U.S. cannot roust up less than $1 billion that is necessary to push forward the IMF reform? So the chances that they can come to the ADB with any real money on the table, I think, are pretty slim, irrespective of what happens in the presidential elections next year. So I don't think the U.S. is in a position to credibly say they will apply for membership to the ADB unless China lets them in for free in one of its more generous moments. But I think the issue that Ken raised is really the critical one. I think the U.S. will need to start reflecting on how it's going to engage in a world economy where it's not the power that it used to be, where other countries are beginning to play a bigger and at least most often constructive roles in terms of how to generate international reforms.
I'm a Japanese, and I can I should not make comments on on the U.S. government's decision. But I think there are several things that the U.S. government needs to consider. One is that even after the U.S. joins, the AIIB would continue to be dominated by developing member countries, because regional economies would have voting share between 70 and 75%, or at least capital contribution shares. And the non-regionals would have maximum 30%, currently 25%. So the U.S. Would have to work within that 25% or 30%. So the U.S. Voting share would be much smaller than China's voting share. Can the U.S. accept that? Okay, and also now the discussion is going on about how to run AIIB, focusing on the roles of executive directors. They are non-resident, and it's not clear at this point how much power the board members would have. There is a discussion that Mr. Jin Li Chun wants to see a higher power on the part of the management. So can the U.S. accept that? Another point is that the U.S. was has been an important member of AIIB, ADB, the Asian Development Bank. Japan and the U.S. are number one capital contribution countries. But the U.S., up until about 7 years ago, the U.S. Had been playing a sort of an opposition party role at the ADB. The U.S. Kept criticizing the way that Japan would run the ADB. And that sort of input has been very constructive, in my view. That has been putting a lot of pressure on the ADB to improve itself. And as a result, now ADB is one of the best MDBs. I'm sure David knows. So if the U.S. joins, despite all of these problems, I think the U.S. would continue to criticize AIIB. I think if the U.S. joins, then the U.S. would become a number two shareholder country, exceeding Japan. So the U.S. could play a constructive role. But the question is whether the U.S. could accept a much smaller, role, official role within AIIB.
Really interesting, Kawai-san. A lot to chew on, and I think we already have reactions. So, Saori, and then David.
So I'm not actually addressing whether U.S. should get on board or not, but I think currently U.S. has two items that they are working on to kind of use its power to influence. One is obviously kind of a informal advisory role, or the link that World Bank as well as ADB would have with AIIB. So, obviously the World Bank is already on board in collaborating with the AIIB. It was already announced that ADB will do the same or more kind of co-financing and things like that. Very close collaboration with it. And in addition to that, I think the U.S. is sending a lot of advisors, including Dr. Dollar to kind of advise on how to create AIIB to be the kind of top-notch institution. I think another lawyer by the name of Lichtenstein, Dr. Lichtenstein, is also involved in setting up the legal structure of AIIB. So all these things are informal influence without kind of necessarily joining that U.S. can kind of conduct on the AIIB. On the other hand, I think we kind of shift into this TPP issue. I think AIIB has, in some ways, made the stake for passing or the kind of agreement on TPP much higher for the U.S. And obviously, we don't know whether it's going to come out positive because it has to do with 11 other countries and so on. But for the Obama administration, this one, because of the AIIB, even though it's a finance issue versus trade, I think when it comes to the rules and the kind of initiatives that U.S. can have on the Asia front, I think this has kind of made this very crucial.
Thank you. David?
Yeah, let me just add a couple things about AIIB. The Chinese team from the Ministry of Finance has been setting this up for over a year. You know, starting a year ago, they invited at least eight retired World Bank staff to advise them. You can't really say we were sent by the U.S. government,
Yeah.
I mean, it just, I don't think it's fair to the U.S. government, because at the time that most of us were getting involved, this was the time Ken was talking about where the U.S. was neutral or perhaps negative. But, I think it showed, something on the part of the Chinese officials that they wanted to learn from the experience of the existing banks. Some of the people they brought in are the leading experts on procurement and on environmental safeguards, social safeguards. And so we'll have to see what the outcome is. But mm-hmm. I think right from the start, the Chinese technocrats were determined to create something that would be similar to the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank, but improved, frankly. You know, they're trying to improve on it. For example, they're going to hire nationals. You know, Americans can apply for jobs there. Japanese can apply for jobs there. You don't have to be from a country that's a member in order to work for the AIIB. And companies can bid on contracts. You don't have to be from a member country. So Japanese firms can bid on contracts. We'll have to see how that works out. But the procurement guidelines, I think, are really, really top-notch that have come out of this process. But now, having said that, I also want to add that I don't really think AIIB is all that important. You know, it's an interesting development. Totally agree that TPP is much more important. You know, AIIB can be one more useful source of funding for infrastructure, but I think the policy framework is much more important, and TPP is an opportunity to create a much more integrated Asia-Pacific economy. And it's disappointing we've only got about a dozen countries to start, but they are important countries. And my own hope would be that we get this agreed soon, we get it implemented, and we start getting additional countries that are attracted to join. In the long run, successful TPP is probably going to be much more influential than any development bank.
And you know I can talk TPP all day.
Yeah, yeah.
But before we do that, I have a couple of points on AIIB, putting it in the right perspective. But the world is going to be watching like a hawk to see what China does with this institution, whether it can really live up to the expectations of high standards and so forth. So one question I have is that China has made the case that the other institutions, certainly the World Bank, are very bureaucratic, and they take very long time in approving loans and so forth. So they want to expedite the process, so to have a more nimble institution. At the same time, they have said that they care deeply about the environment and other types of goals and so forth. So how can the Chinese get it right? I mean, how can they achieve both? How can they get the high standards and the streamlined decision-making procedures? That seems to me a hard thing to do.
It's very tough. You're absolutely right, Maria. It's very tough. I predict they stay away from very controversial things. I predict they stay away from big dams, for example, where it's just really hard to get that right. But the key to this, I do think, is implementation. You know, my own experience 20 years in the World Bank is, we would often, of course, we do an environmental assessment for a project, and often there'd be a clear set of choices. But mm-hmm. the reluctant bureaucracy would ask for additional studies and just very reluctant to make any kind of, yes or no decision. Just postpone, let's do more studies. So there is some hope that the new bank will be more decisive. You know, it'll get the environmental assessment, and it'll make a determination. Is this, when you factor in the environmental aspects, is this a net benefit to society? In theory, it shouldn't be that hard, but let's see what happens in practice. So.
Well, I understand that AIIB has excellent experts from the World Bank, relatively young retired people and from other institutions. But to run a bank, you know, even if you have a top, you know, top-notch people at the top, people actually working do matter. And that's a very important issue. The second point is that in Latin America, you know, there is the Inter-American Development Bank, which is like ADB, mm-hmm. and also CAF, yeah. Andean Development Fund, mm-hmm. and CAF is established by basically Latin American countries. Mm-hmm. With small capital contributions by Portugal and Spain. But basically CAF is like AIIB. One of the advantages of CAF has been that the environmental standards do not have to be as high as IDB. You know, national environmental standards and social standards would be used rather than global, and bureaucratic procedures are much, much shorter. And these two have been a great advantage for Latin American countries. So as a result, loans made by CAF have expanded enormously. A similar thing may happen at AIIB. Whether this sort of competition with low standards and also, you know, without having resident board members and management deciding almost everything. As a result, the process, bureaucratic process, would be much less. Questions remain as to whether this sort of competition should be encouraged or should be regulated.
You're never going to convince Eshwar and me about the resident board, okay? The resident board's a nightmare, basically. You got non-experts. It just creates a lot of confusion among the staff about who's actually making decisions. You don't have any major corporation that has a resident board of directors, basically. And I know it's a different business, but, you know, but I agree with Maria that there's going to be enormous scrutiny. You know, they're going to do projects in India and Indonesia, Philippines, Vietnam. These countries all have very active civil societies. To me, that's the best protection on the environmental issues, is that civil society scrutiny.
You're an expert in Japan, so let me flip it on the question to you. Should Japan and will it get involved in the AIIB?
Well, we're going to get into that in a few minutes, and I have two guests that have prepared that. So let me hold off on that one, okay. And I'll promise I'll comment on that when we get to that. Because I do want to ask a very big question in the sense that we talked about whether China is a revisionist power or not. Some people have criticized the United States because they argue that the United States is playing an exclusion strategy. And they point to the following things in making that case. One is the fact that China is not in the TPP, the containment argument, if you will. The fact that the United States has not delivered on the reform of the IMF or other Bretton Woods institutions, the fact that the United States has not joined, perhaps cannot join AIB, and therefore that they should be separate institutions and that they're trying to play a defensive tactic vis-a-vis China. And others would completely disagree with this characterization of U.S. policy, and they would argue that this is not what's driving the United States, that the United States actually wants to work with China, welcome China into the WTO, and we're just finding our way with the new institutions. And that would be more towards an inclusion strategy. I wonder if Americans and Japanese alike, if you can share your views as to what kind of, I mean, grand strategy might be too ambitious. Perhaps we don't have that. But what kind of approach do you think is more consistent with the facts? Is the United States playing an inclusion approach or an exclusion approach?
I would say definitely inclusive. You know, I think you mentioned a few specific issues, but if we stand back and look at the bigger picture, you know, the United States has been remarkably friendly to China in the economic realm. You know, China exports $400+ billion of goods to the United States. This has been an enormous advantage for the Chinese economy. You know, they've bought treasury bonds in order to manage their exchange rate. People sometimes talk about the U.S. being in debt to China. I see it as we have open capital markets, and we've graciously allowed the Chinese to participate very substantially. Now that we're the biggest destination of their direct foreign investment. So I think objectively, you know, the United States has been extremely engaging with China. And I'm a little disappointed that the Chinese have been slow to reciprocate. They still have a much more closed economy, a lot of restrictions on foreign investment. I think they're missing an opportunity. But your question is really about the U.S. attitude. I think on the economic side, it's really very positive. And then you can add in little annoyances, which matter a lot to the Chinese. The fact that the U.S. won't ratify this IMF agreement, it's hugely important to the Chinese. So it undermines everything I said, which I think is big picture, is undermined by a few relatively small things, but those are real for the Chinese.
Do you think, exactly, do you think the Chinese understand that in terms of overall approach, the United States wants to work with China, but then there are the messy, unwieldy domestic politics, the Congress not moving on the IMF reform? Do you think that they see that, they make that distinction?
So I've been in plenty of meetings with senior Chinese leaders. I think they get what I said, and they often start the meeting by some short version of what I just said, you know. But frankly, in the Chinese media, the Chinese internet, a lot of focus on these negative things. In U.S. opposing AIB, U.S. not supporting China, China's growing weight in the IMF. So you definitely have a very dynamic narrative in social media in China that the U.S. is trying to keep China down economically. You know, which I find a little bit ironic and frustrating because I think the United States has been really quite engaging.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
I think there's this institutional competition going on, right? And I think the strategy could be either inclusionary, i.e. expand the members as much as possible, or exclusionary and make the kind of externality so costly of being excluded from that institution that they are incentivized to join. So obviously TPP, even though originally, and you write about this a lot, originally China is not a member, but it's considered a shadow negotiator as everybody kind of have China in mind as they negotiate. And in the long run, if TPP is very successful, China inevitably has to join once it's ready or to become ready to join the TPP. So in some ways, I think this competition drives, but the nature of maybe issue areas or the way it emerged makes it either inclusionary strategy or exclusionary strategy to prevail over this. So again, whether you call it the revisionist or reformist, you know, that's up to the kind of view of beholder, I guess. But still, I think that competition has different strategies depending on the situation.
Yes, thank you. Ken, I think you had a...
Well, it's certainly not. I very much associate myself with both sets of comments here. I think we clearly have not sought to pursue an exclusionary strategy. Some of the specifics have seemed to belie that. I think often those specifics have turned on domestic U.S. politics rather than on a grand strategy for how we're dealing with China's larger role in the world. And the Chinese, not surprisingly, have focused on some of those specifics and made more of them than reality should warrant, to my mind. In the future, it's obviously not going to be totally inclusive or totally exclusionary. It's going to depend on a wide mix of factors domestically and internationally in the U.S. and China and in the global economy. But I think the fundamental effort on the U.S. side will be to have an evolution in the multilateral institutions that does take account of a larger role for China and for other relatively successful developing countries, but really work to not have that lead to changes in standards that roll back what those institutions have become in terms of environmental standards, corruption, you name it, over a period of years. Now, whether we can manage that effectively is
it's a question, but sure. I think that will be the approach.
Thank you. Kawai-san.
Yeah, given the extremely large size of the Chinese economy and the existing economic linkage between China and other developed countries, it's not productive or possible to exclude China from the international economic architecture. I think that's clear. So we need to encourage China to play an productive role in the international economic system, and particularly in the area of rules-based arrangement. It's extremely important to pull China into a rules-based economic system and encourage China to abide by that. And of course, if China is unhappy about the existing rule, then China can make a point within that system. So this this sort of exercise is it's increasingly important. So in that sense, AIIB is posing a big challenge for everybody. Even if the U.S. and Japan may not become members of AIIB, the two countries can encourage China and AIIB members to play a constructive role from an international economic perspectives.
Mm-hmm. So let's bring in Japan to discussion, as we were asking for. Japan and the United States, obviously everybody has noted, they're not in the list of founding members, right? Would you say that there is full convergence in the views of the United States and Japan regarding the AIIB, regarding what this institution stands for, regarding the strategy of involvement with that institution, or do you think that there are gaps in the way in which these two countries think about AIIB?
Well, at this point, I think the two countries are relatively in full agreement and full convergence. I think the two countries take the view of wait and see. Ken, you said it would be better for the U.S. to see for a few years what sort of organization AIIB is going to be, what sort of projects are going to be run, and whether the projects would be environmentally sound, whether projects would pay a lot of attention to people affected by the projects. So this wait and see approach is the approach that Japan also takes. Also, the two countries encourage the existing MDBs, the World Bank and ADB, to work with AIIB, which is the way to go. But having said that, Japan being in Asia and Japan being a big supporter of infrastructure investment in Asia, perhaps Japan has a bigger stake in Asia in terms of infrastructure development than the United States. Mm. So if certain conditions are met, at least from the point of view of Japan, perhaps Japan may be more eager to join AIIB. And in the case of the United States, this is something David or Esra mentioned, the U.S. Congress bringing this AIIB issue to the U.S. Congress could encounter a great deal of difficulty, given that the IMF reform hasn't gone through. So this political constraint may be less in Japan if conditions and other situations improve. The two top leaders in China and Japan have not been meeting, frequently. They have met only in the corridors last year once and this year once. They have not sat down, just like President Obama and President Xi Jinping. They have not spent hours together. So this sort of political situation has to improve between the two countries for Japan to improve, to join AIIB, and other conditions have to be met.
And sorry, I'm going to go to you in a second, but I also want to introduce another set of issues as we continue with the discussion about Japan's response to the AIIB initiative. Because I agree that there is convergence in the wait-and-see approach, but it seems to me that perhaps people are not aware that Japan has done quite a bit, perhaps much more than the United States, in fashioning a response to the AIIB initiative. Three things come to mind. One is the announcement of a $110 billion quality infrastructure fund. The other one is the very quick set of reforms of the ADB, increasing the lending capacity, streamlining loan approvals. And third, forthcoming, is a change to the law that governs the Japan Bank for International Cooperation. And the way people have explained it to me is that the bank is now going to display a greater acceptance of risk, meaning that they can now participate in a set of projects in infrastructure, which we all know tends to be in the high-risk category sometimes, that perhaps were off-limits, but now the bank can participate. So why don't we know more about this initiative? I mean, maybe Washington is too focused on what the U.S. does, but I think that Japan has perhaps shown a way in which you can actually meet in a constructive way, if you're not yet going all the way into membership in the AIIB, but you can be very proactive about how you react to it.
I would like to follow up what Kawai-san said and maybe address to your question too. So, you know, for Japan, the stake is really high. You know, Japan is, after all, an Asian country. Japan has been the leader in providing public goods to Southeast Asia and, you know, various other places nearby. And, you know, ADB is Japan's basically a kind of an important project. So, and in addition to that, for the Abe cabinet or Abe's prime ministership, he has been courting Southeast Asia very actively. He has visited all these places, and, you know, he's been kind of proposing this Japan's, you know, kind of revamping Japan's leadership, Japan is back kind of notion. So, you know, not to do anything about this is not an option for Japan. Thus comes all these very active initiatives, because Japan was not able to join, you know, kind of a misstep, and, you know, had to go with the American position along with it. I think Japan has done quite a bit, and I don't know why Americans has not picked it up. Maybe, you know, it's like rubbing the salt on the wound that's still kind of, you know, hurting, because, oh, Japan is doing this. You know, why can't Congress do that? So that might be the case. But one thing I would like to note is, no, this, what is it, $110 billion is a little bit of a misrepresentation, because JBIC's fund, I think if I remember correctly, only went up for this fund, from this project, went up on 30%. So, yes, it's a commitment, but not in the kind of same promotional way that you hear from the Japanese government. So that's one. But I think what's crucial is, you know, two things that you mentioned, of the three. One is this changes in JBIC's the kind of legal structure, so that it can take more risk. And risk will be backed up by the government budget. And they're going to discuss it at the lower house, I think, in the spring. So that would really mean Japan will be taking on quite a bit of more risk. I think that's the same kind of way that World Bank is. I think it has Japanese foreign aid and investment guarantee and so on has gotten even quite a bit bureaucratic and risk-averse. So that would this would help Japan take on some of the kind of infrastructure needs, which Japan has not been able to address. The other thing is obviously the changes in the ADB and approach that Mr. Nakao, the the head of ADB has towards the AIIB. I think they have had quite a few discussions starting May. And again, just recently, Nakao met with President-designate Dr. Jin to discuss the collaboration and co-financing. So these are very, very important steps that Japan has taken. They have to really do this in order to make sure that Japan has the, you know, kind of shows this leadership and maintain the reputation of the public good provider in the region. Just want to mention one thing about the politics. I think that, so whether Japan can join or not, and it's not only the leadership I worry about, but it's the anti-China sentiment in the LDP party. I did some hearing of the people who are involved this AIIB issue back in Tokyo a few weeks ago, and a couple of them who are called in to testify about, you know, kind of report about this AIIB in front of the LDP members, said that, you know, whenever people who are the expert who have some positive thing to say about AIIB, the LDP members said, no, you know? And the other one who said, well, no, this is not going to work, it's going to be, you know, suspicious and so on, then the LDP member kind of perks up. So that type of, you know, LDP members who would be voting on the fund and so on would be, you know, kind of a similar note as the U.S. Congress have this, you know, remnants of, you know, kind of resistance to join an AIIB. Obviously, wait-and-see approach is what Japan is taking, I agree, but there might be some political undercurrent that makes it much harder than one would expect for Japan to join.
And I have a question for you, Kawai-san. This goes back to a conversation you already were having. I hear a lot of people say they're not still quite certain whether the transparency will be there. And they always go back to this board of directors issue that you already discussed, where there is a difference of opinion, I think, in the panel. Do you think if China was prepared to, and I don't know if it's even in the cards, maybe David can also comment on that, but would this be something that could be a make or break issue for Japan? I mean, if China were to put that on the table, would that sort of help alleviate concerns about the lack of transparency in the bank? What do you think would it take? There are the political issues, the geopolitical issues, but what do you think it would take for Japan to decide to join AIIB?
Well, if according to my calculation, if Japan joins AIIB, Japan would get a number two voting share, provided that the U.S. does not join. Mm-hmm. And so that's in theory. Whether that would be the arrangement that China would give to Japan remains an issue, because as a new member, when you join the existing MDB, sometimes capital increase is not made, so your capital contribution could be very small. Whether that's an issue that's related to the governance and Japan's voice at the AIIB. Now, on the issue of transparency, I am increasingly worried because of the possibility of diminished role of directors. Mm-hmm. Directors are not going to be resident mm-hmm. in Beijing. Mm-hmm. Directors are located in different capital cities. And board of directors meeting would be held infrequently, and also the power of the board members could be limited. I think one of the important considerations would be how much power would be given to the board members. A maximum power should be given to the board members. But at the same time, of course, bureaucratic procedures needs to be streamlined. I fully agree on that point. But basically, whether the governance by shareholders could be exercised or not, that's a very, very important consideration. So during the wait-and-see period, no matter what sort of governance arrangement is made, I think it will be important for Japan and the United States and outside us, like Canada also, to see what sort of projects are being implemented and how they are implemented and who are the main beneficiaries. I think that's the kind of thing that Japan would need to take a look. And how much public goods are really being provided as a result of the actual projects, rather than benefiting China, largely China, and rather than serving China's narrow economic, political, and geopolitical interests. That's a kind of thing that Japan needs to take a look. And also, more important is something Saori said, the political relationship between Japan and China, that has to improve. There is a lack of trust between the two countries, and it's, Japan cannot join in the absence of mutual trust. So this the bilateral relationship has to improve substantially. That would mean a lesser conflict on the Senkaku Island issue and China's behavior in the South China Sea, islands or reefs. So I think these two are going to be still major issues. So we need to see significant improvements over the next several years.
Very, very interesting. So I realize that the audience is very patient, and I probably would have to turn soon to ask them to share with us the questions they may have. But I just want to also talk a little bit about future scenarios and where we're going. What's the road ahead? We talked about earlier that we don't know yet exactly how far will China's growing penchant for, new institutions and so forth, where will this take us? And we know that, for example, in the past, Japan proposed an Asian Monetary Fund, and that initiative went nowhere. Do you think that China could make proposals in this new area, a new type of Asian IMF? Where do you see China putting forward new initiatives in terms of international economic governance?
Well, yes, certainly China could make a proposal of a new Asian International Monetary Fund, AMF. This idea was proposed during the Asian financial crisis by Japan, supported by ASEAN countries and Korea. And of course, at that time, the IMF said no. The United States said no. And because of the lack of support, clear support from China, China did not oppose then, but Japan had to withdraw the idea. Now China could come and say that we are going to propose an AMF. And if Japan is interested, Japan could join. If the U.S. is interested, the U.S. could join. China could make that sort of proposal, but on the other hand, there is an undergoing project going on the Chiang Mai Initiative, and also the ASEAN Plus 3 Macroeconomic Research Office being established and serving as a secretariat for the Chiang Mai Initiative. And China is playing a very important role, as well as Japan, Korea, and ASEAN countries. So I think if China makes that proposal, China should also consult with other ASEAN Plus 3 members, because the new Asian Monetary Fund cannot go independently of the Chiang Mai Initiative and AMRO, the ASEAN Plus 3 Macroeconomic Research Office. So China could make a proposal, but my expectation is that other ASEAN plus three members would say, well, the proposal should be made by all these countries, yeah. not China alone. Mm. So certainly, I think that's possible.
AMF proposal and the AIIB has kind of a similarity, but the contrast. Similarity is that U.S. had this very kind of negative reaction right away, saying, no, don't challenge our established framework. But I think the difference is that I think at the time of AMF, it was a zero-sum game where if AMF is introduced, there'll be a moral hazard, you know, IMF's authority will be challenged and so on. So they couldn't kind of make sure that debtors will pay the whole, you know, kind of what they owe. While AIIB and World Bank, I think it's a positive sum. You know, they need infrastructure, you know, $8 trillion of infrastructure need in Asia. So, yes, obviously, governance is important, but also the fund itself would be added, and that will be a good thing. So in some ways, this time, I think China has an easier sell, not only because China's a rising power and, well, rised power, risen power, and also has a major, you know, major economy, but because of the nature of the issue that they are tackling.
So as I think about China, Japan, and the U.S., I want to go back to my initial metaphor that China is an awkward adolescent getting used to adulthood. As a parent of a daughter who's attaining teenage years, I can tell you that it's a difficult adjustment for the adults as well in the room. In particular, Japan and the U.S., I think, are going to have to get used to treating China and indeed other emerging market economies as adults who are equals at the table. And this is a very difficult challenge for me and for adults in general, sensing that our authority is not what it used to be, that we need to start treating others as partners, at least to some level. And that's not an easy adjustment to make. And I think some of what we've seen in these reactions to the AIIB and so forth reflects that. Now, having said that, I think the U.S. and some of its bilateral dialogues with China, with India, has started taking a different approach where it's not so much lecturing about the U.S. being the epitome towards which other countries should aspire, but viewing it as more of a collaborative relationship where the U.S. does have some things to share with China and India, and this is ultimately going to work well for all three countries. But the domestic political circumstances do end up constraining both Japan and the U.S. in terms of providing the sort of leadership in a shifting world, and that I think is going to have a detrimental effect both in terms of the role that these two countries can play in the international economic order, and frankly, for the international economic order itself, because it creates a lot of instability, whereas these two pillars, I think, were fairly important. I think Sayuri made this important point that as one thinks about the AIIB, the TPP, and so on, the stakes for Japan are significantly higher. It has, although China owns a lot of U.S. Treasury securities, the nature of American dependence on China is very different from the nature of Japanese dependence, both political and economic, on China. They are neighbors. They do have competing interests in the region, both economic and geopolitical. So it's going to be a relationship that has to be managed, I think, much more carefully. But for China, I think it's there are enough initiatives and new institutions on the table, as our discussion has suggested. The big issue now is whether they can be implemented well and whether China can, in fact, meet these standards that it aspires to and that the rest of the world is looking to. And I think that is very much where the focus is right now, rather than thinking about new proposals to put on the table. So for the next, for the short term at least, what I would anticipate seeing is not new big proposals from China, but attempts to get these initial initiatives working in the right way. And that, I think, is going to be interesting to watch and very important for the international economic order.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, frequently people have alluded to the fact that we may be heading towards a world in international economic governance where the emerging economies play a larger role, just reflecting the realities of where we are at today. But this also brings a question as to whether China is in a league of its own or whether other emerging economies, the BRICS countries, can also become more active, aspire to a higher profile, have their own views of economic governance that may or may not match what China has in mind. So India, for example, comes to mind. In the world of international trade, I have to say, India does not appear as incredibly ambitious. Frequently, when India participates in a trade negotiation, that brings down sometimes the level of aspiration, if I may be as direct as that. But are there other emerging economies, you think, that will be stepping up to the plate? Can they provide public goods? Can they come up with new alternatives? Or is it a China discussion?
I think China's in a league of its own, and that we've created a certain amount of confusion talking about the BRICS, you know, because China is just so much bigger and has such global aspirations. India has to grow really, really well for 20 years to be where China is now. And I wish India well. I hope they do. And so 20 years from now, we certainly you could be looking at a very different situation. But I think for the next decade, you know, it's really China that's the emerging power. And it is useful to put in the larger context because developing countries as a whole are increasing their share. And these other countries we're mentioning, they're all increasing their shares, but they're just going to be relatively small shares for the foreseeable future. So I really think it is China accommodating China's position in these institutions that's really the key issue.
I agree with David. On the other hand, other countries may play an increasingly important role in their own regions, or India's role in South Asia. Hopefully, Brazil will be playing a more proactive role in Latin America. On the other hand, compared to AIIB, the new development bank of BRICS, in my view, would be much less effective because it's equally owned by the BRICS countries rather than predominantly owned by China. So AIIB would play a much more important role than the BRICS. But as I said, other countries would be playing increasingly important roles in their regions.
So let me ask a very big picture question. We talked about whether China's a revisionist or reformist power. We talked about whether the established powers are making sufficient room to accommodate these change in relative capabilities or not in established Bretton Woods institutions, but also having an open mind about new institutions. And I think when people discuss this, they want to know if ahead of us we have a period of growing a strategic rivalry, or whether we think that there could be successful communication, successful engagement, and therefore that we can find a way to collaborate in the management of the world economy. So what would be the markers to tell us where are we going? I know this is an extremely challenging question, but I think it's probably in the back of everybody's minds here. We care about this because what this may mean for the quality of governance in the future, but also for the quality of interaction among the major powers in the world. So where are we heading?
I'll take an initial stab.
Wise choice.
Every time you comment, Maria, that now I have a much bigger question. Your question, too, indeed, keep getting bigger, but the first of those I thought was big enough at the start. I guess if you look at the U.S. and China, we seek now to cooperate as much as we can on major global issues. Those are especially in areas now like climate change, nuclear nonproliferation. We are developing more cooperation in counterterrorism, in military-to-military relations. We are moving that forward. So when you talk about what the nature of the relationships will be in the future. The economic side is a part of that, but it's, you know, many of these other issues determine the degree of trust in the long-term intentions of another country. And my sense is at this point, this doesn't fully deal with your question, obviously, but as a starting point, my sense is at this point that the U.S. and China are able to have considerable confidence in the agreements that they reach on in a number of different areas. We understand each other pretty well. What we are very unclear about is the long-term intentions of the other country, and so how much you can trust them strategically down the road. And I think that's a work in progress. And there's no single item that's going to flip a switch on that, shy of some huge escalatory event. But very likely this is going to be a matter of, as this whole conversation has suggested, where we focus primarily on you know, the central issues of this panel, is how do these institutions develop? How do we react over time? And do we build confidence, or on balance, are things going to move in a different direction? One last comment I'd make is that I know this is somewhat outside the scope of this panel, but I think one of the big issues that will affect thinking about China's revisionism or not is going to be the One Belt, One Road effort and how that plays out. And I'm, frankly, I have more confidence in the AIB than I do in the One Belt, One Road.
Very good point. Sorry, and then Kawai-san.
Yes, so I think the sense that marker that you're looking for, and I don't think I have the best answer, but my answer would be the level of interdependence. And interdependence does not only mean the economic interdependence, which is obviously a big, major part between, you know, among U.S., China, and Japan, and beyond, where the interdependence create domestic support for more stable, more amicable, you know, more kind of a collaborative relationship with each other, that will change the domestic environment. And again, you know, Japan and China has such a large interdependence, and you know, Japan and China has to work on that. But I think that this continues with, you know, like student exchanges and everything else. I think that's the marker of our being, you know, being able to feel a little bit safe of the major clash kind of going forward. But that would be my two cents.
Well, I think one of the most important determinants of whether we are going to have a collaborative international economic system, including China, is to what extent China can be successful in its economic reform. So we have to go back to the initial issue of this session.
Yes.
I think you know, China is under transformation towards more consumption-led, services-led, and more market-based economic system, including financial market reform and financial market opening, capital account opening. I think if China clearly moves towards that direction in a visible way, then the chance of having a more collaborative system would be there.
Excellent. Any other comments?
The leaders on the two sides, U.S. and China, leaders have for a long time said the economic relationship was the foundation of the overall relationship, and I don't think this is true anymore. I think the economic relationship is stagnating, and that, as Ken was intimating, I think the real positive area of U.S.-China relations is cooperation on global public goods like climate change and you know, non-proliferation in Iran, these kind of issues. And that's positive, but I worry that that can easily be kind of opportunistic, and without that deeper economic integration, that may not persist. So when you look for markers, I would be looking for, do we get a bilateral investment treaty between China and the United States? Do we get TPP? Does China eventually join TPP or negotiate some kind of free trade agreement with the U.S.? I think without, you know, deeper economic institutional integration, I think it's going to be hard to advance all aspects of the relationship. And then the risks of conflict become much greater.
Very good. Great. So I think the audience has been extremely patient, and I would like now to give him the opportunity to ask questions. We have hopefully some mics going around. I would like you to please identify yourself and be very concise in the question, because I imagine that there's a number of people that have questions to ask. So maybe this lady and the lady behind her, and I'm going to take two or three questions at a time.
Thank you all for the great panel. I'm Jennifer Liang with Hong Kong Phoenix TV. My question is regarding President Xi and President Obama's meeting last week. If we read the fact sheet they released after the meeting, we can find the economic relations is at a relatively longer length. So I want also on the international economic governments, they also talk about many issues like G20, IMF, or World Bank and other banks. But I didn't see any AIIB mentioned in the fact sheet. So I wonder, after the meeting, how would you foresee the collaboration between United States and China on the economic issues, specifically on the international economic governance? It's going to be more optimistic from your perspective? Thank you.
Thank you very much. And then there was another question from this lady, please.
Jessica Liao from Monash University, Kuala Lumpur. I have a question for all the panelists, particularly for Dr. Dollard and Professor Lieberthong, who have like personal interaction with a lot of Chinese officials. So taking from all the panelists' discussion, I think the contribution of China's economic governance by providing new loans to particularly Southeast Asia really depends on the rule of conduct. And the rule of conduct really, like, boiled down to the end, is a political will. So Professor Lieberthong talked about a really important point on the last discussion, is the difference between AIIB and the One Belt, One Road. So just wondering, what is the political consensus among the top leadership now in terms of its conduct? I know there are a lot of discussion, and they come a long way. In the beginning, when they provide the AIIB, they're thinking about, oh, that might be an opportunity for us to promote export and so forth. And that idea was shut down after all the major, like most of the major economies joined the AIIB. And in the past few decades, like when they're providing loan to Southeast Asia, there are a lot of problems, especially human rights and environmental issues they run into. So I was wondering, what is the political will that is actually there, and what do they see themselves can do in terms of, like, you know, disciplining the conduct of loan?
Thank you very much. One last question from this gentleman on this round, and then I'll ask for answers from the panelists. This gentleman.
My name is Sajjad. I am from Bangladesh. I am an author. I have traveled to China many, many times, and I have a lot of known people there. If I would have talked to six luminous people like you, in 1 hour, 40 minutes, there would be Japan bashup and China and U.S. bashup. Only thing they love about America is McDonald's only. So I would like to say that the relationship with China that you discussed about, I beg to disagree. These are aspirations, not realities. China wants to be a rule maker and not more a rule taker also. China is getting very aggressive with its hydro behavior. They already have set up four deep sea ports for military use in Indian Ocean. And
Would you mind making a question just
I just want to differ a little bit. Okay. And China has got no public opinion. It only has published opinion. So when we talk about this interacting with China, we should also remember that there's a dangerous cocktail of economy which is in China, and this is the tale of growth of corruption and favoritism and politics into the economy, which we may have to think about.
Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much. All right, so reactions.
Well, luckily for us, we don't have to worry about favoritism and politics in the U.S. here. And these are difficult issues. When one engages with China, certainly there are areas in which there are common interests between China and the U.S. and Japan as well, and there are areas where there is inevitably going to be conflict, especially when it comes to geopolitical issues, and China is trying to expand its influence. So I think the key issue is how one can think about these many, many areas of common interest. I think there are areas of economic common interest. Both the U.S. and the Chinese and Japanese economies can grow by collaborating with each other. But and likewise, if you think about climate change, there are common interests. So how one balances those common interests with the inevitable conflicts, I think, is the key issue that leaders in all of these countries face. And that, as David pointed out, is going to be a work in progress, and there is no way to reconcile some of those interests. But the question is whether one is going to let those areas of conflict supersede the areas where I think there can be some creative collaboration among the countries. And the signs are not entirely positive, but as we've seen from the climate change agreement, at least there is hope. But of course, domestic economics and domestic politics, as Kawai-san pointed out, do intrude. So even if there are aspirations to do things cooperatively at the international level, there are domestic constraints as well that need to be dealt with. So it's complex.
It is. So two more questions. We have time for two more questions. Okay, so these two gentlemen, please.
Hi, I'm Brock Williams with the Congressional Research Service, and the panel mentioned that it was important from a U.S. perspective to bring China into a rules-based economic system, and I would say that some might argue that that has already been done to a large extent through China's involvement in the WTO, and I was wondering how successful you think that process has been and what role there is in the WTO for advancing that.
But there's another question, yes. But just we'll listen to this other question, and then I can certainly provide some comments on that.
Thank you very much for a great presentation. I'm Elliot Hurwitz. I was a contractor for the World Bank for 20 years and a State Department official and Intelligence Committee official before that. China's record in the past has not been very good in the environmental area, although they have made a recent agreement. For example, they violated the World Bank Three Gorges Dam requirements. And so even though they aspired to lead the Asian International Development Bank, or whatever it's called, their environmental policy, as recorded by the American Embassy in Beijing, has not been good. So I would invite any of the panelists to comment on the prospects of Chinese environmental. They have violated the Three Gorges Dam requirements of the World Bank in my time there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So let me just briefly go back to the WTO question. I do think it has been a major success to bring China into the WTO. It has been a good situation for China and for the world. The problem is that the WTO actually now suffers from dysfunction at the negotiation in the negotiation area. And when you think about how the world economy continues to be transformed, many of the rules negotiated in WTO do not cover the newer areas, the global supply chain issues, for example. So the question we ask ourselves is, well, where are the new rules going to come from? And that's, I think, the main intention of the TPP. And that's why people talk about trying to create an incentive structure whereby China will think it's in its own interest to join the TPP, and in that way also gain leverage in its own domestic reform. So it's a question of adding to the WTO, because unfortunately the WTO, the Doha round, is not making any progress and has not been able for the past 20 years to generate membership-wide rules on trade and investment. Any comments on
that? Just following up on your comment, involving China within a rules-based international monetary system is absolutely needed. It's been done, but more needs to be done. And the experience of the WTO shows that it's been successful. China has been able to grow following the entry to the WTO, and China knows it. And dispute settlement system of the WTO would subject China to an issue where China is accused for violating the WTO rules, and China can bring other countries to the dispute settlement process. So this kind of rule is extremely useful, and China has been learning this process. China has been a member of the World Bank and ADB, and China has been also learning how the World Bank works and ADB works. China's main interest in getting loans from the World Bank and the ADB, despite the fact that China has financial resources, has been to learn from the World Bank and ADB on various issues, for procurement, safeguards, environmental safeguards, other issues that would have to be dealt with in relation to infrastructure projects. So overall, this process has been quite successful. On the issue of the environmental protection and safeguards, I think it's going to be a challenge. I think David has said so. It's a challenge for China. International NGOs, civil society may be watching, and China would have to be conducting a lot of consultations with the local communities, international NGOs, and various other stakeholders. This is a new challenge for China, for its infrastructure project. So I think, I personally want to continue to watch, and many people would be watching how China would do in the AIIB projects. Domestically, on domestic projects, I wasn't aware of the specific case of three gorges dam projects by the World Bank, and I don't know the extent of violation. Maybe David knows, but I think looking forward, everybody would be scrutinizing China's and AIIB's operations starting from next year.
Let me just add that China continues to be a large borrower from the World Bank, and most of the focus of the program now is actually on environmental issues. And certainly over the last decade or so, China's had a very good track record of implementing these projects, without any problems. The World Bank did not provide any financing to the Three Gorges Dam.
In fact, they denied it.
Right. Basically, so you can say that China didn't want the World Bank involved, and you're right, they didn't meet World Bank standards, but the World Bank wasn't involved at all. So I just want to be clear about that. So there was no violation of a legal agreement in a sense, because World Bank was not involved. But lots of examples of World Bank projects, cleaning up rivers and lakes. Environmental picture in China is mixed. I mean, you read a lot of the negative stuff in American newspapers, but there are also progress in cleaning up rivers and lakes. Some cities are improving their air pollution, so it's a mixed picture. But I think the technocrats developing AIIB, and they've got so many different countries involved now, and President Xi actually said out loud that they're committed to meeting international standards in AIIB operations. So I think, let's pitch in and help them succeed in that.
Great. So I think we've had an exhaustive discussion. It's been terrific. But I think it's time to wrap it up. Thank you so much. Please join me in thanking the panelists for sharing their experience.